On Obeying Government, the 46th talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 29, 2011, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in Romans chapter 13, part 32, paragraph 112, if you have printed off my translation. I'm not sure how far we'll get. I want to take it partway into this passage and then pause for any questions or comments that you have, and then if we have time, we'll go a little bit further. But I'm going to read the first part that I hope to at least finish this far. Every person is to place himself under the prevailing authorities, for there is no authority if it is not by God, and those that exist have been placed there by God. Consequently, the one who stands in opposition to the authority has taken a stand against the directive of God. Now, those who have taken a stand against it will receive a sentence on themselves. Those who rule are not a terror to good behavior, but to bad behavior. Do you want to be afraid of the authority? Do good, and you will have praise from him, for he is a servant of God for you to bring about a good thing. But if you do bad, then be afraid, for he does not carry the sword without purpose. Indeed, he is a servant of God, an avenger who brings wrath against the one who practices bad behavior. So then, to place oneself under the ruler's authority is a necessity, not only because of the ruler's wrath, but also as a matter of moral conviction. For this reason, to be sure, complete your tribute obligations, for they are ministers of God, attending to God's wishes with regard to this very thing. Give to all the things that are due them. Tribute to the one owed tribute, tax to the one owed tax, fear to the one owed fear, honor to the one owed honor. Okay, that may be as far as we get. We'll see how it goes. There is a fairly typical reading of this passage, at least I think it's typical. No part of Romans that I've given more thought to than this particular passage. The reason being, when I was first being introduced to the Bible and taking the Bible seriously and studying the Bible, we are in the midst of the Vietnam War, and I am not a veteran. The Army wouldn't even take me if I had signed up. So I was surrounded by people who were in opposition to the war. They were demonstrating against it. They were arguing against it. The whole college culture, university culture at that time was committed to blaming American involvement in Vietnam and trying to put an end to it. So I was in the midst of a discussion. We who were Christians, what was our obligation? What were we supposed to do? The government was saying you must serve. There was a draft at that time, as many of you know. So you wouldn't even have an option. If you got drafted, then you would become a soldier and you would go to Vietnam and fight. And there was so much discussion, so much argument, advancing the perspective that it was an evil thing that we were involved in. The government was doing evil, and we were implicated in evil if we actually went and fought and participated. So the debate between Christians is, what does this passage imply about whether or not we should submit to the governing authorities if we should be drafted? Would we cooperate? Would we go ahead and allow them to send us to Vietnam and fight? Or would our moral conscience be so opposed to the evil that the government was involved in that we were morally obligated to oppose them and to in some way or another resist their efforts, go to Canada, go to jail, whatever, but the last thing that we would do would be submit to their evil. Now, that was not my position. I didn't know enough to know whether what we were doing was right or wrong at the time. I was very ignorant. So I was just sort of caught and confused. But all the messages around me were, this is an evil thing. So the question then became, what does this passage have to say if, in fact, you think it's an evil thing that we're involved in? And you were caught between two positions. On the one hand, the side that said, we must resist evil, even if that evil is coming from the government, that sounded very plausible and indeed very biblical in a lot of ways. Things like Peter standing before the Sanhedrin and saying, whether we should obey God or man, I'll let you decide, but as for me, we must obey God. As for me, I must obey God. That rung in our ears. That seemed true. On the other hand, there is this passage that seemed to be saying, if the government sends you to Vietnam, you go to Vietnam. You submit. You don't resist. You don't resist the government. So I never really resolved it. That sounded like what this passage was saying at the time. And I was prepared to go into the army should that befall me. But I didn't know. But the typical interpretation that was informing my thought at that point was that Paul is saying here, we should never, ever disobey government authorities. Those authorities have been put there by God. To disobey government is to disobey the one appointed by God, which is tantamount to disobeying God himself. That sounds like what the passage is saying. Now, nobody would have said that without the disclaimer that, of course, we must always obey God rather than man. So there must be some limits on what the government can require of us because we must never disobey God. So if they ever come into conflict, then certainly you have to obey God. But the burden of proof would be on you to give good reason why you should obey the obey God rather than the government, because that government is there by the authority of God. So the default position should be you always submit to the governing authorities. And I think that's a fairly typical interpretation of this passage. Notice that passage is an interpretation. I'm sorry, that interpretation of this passage is an interpretation that really is without any context. We're not thinking about what is Romans 13 talking about, what's the book of Romans talking about, why is he talking about this here. You just kind of abstract it out of the text and treat it as if it were a standalone unit when you interpret it that way. So what I want to do is to put this in its context and see if that helps us in any way come to terms with what Paul is actually saying. We need to look at it in its textual context here in Romans 13 and 14, and or 12 and 13, I should say, and we need to look at it in its historical context. In its textual context, what have we been dealing with here in Romans? Starting back in Romans 12, the whole third portion of the book of Romans, he begins by asking the question, in view of everything that God has done to show us his profound grace and mercy, how should we live? What should we do? And his fundamental answer to that is, all God wants from you is that you pursue holiness. He makes a disclaimer. It's to pursue holiness rather than accomplishing anything for God. God doesn't need us to accomplish anything. He just needs us to be a certain kind of person, a person who's committed to pursuing holiness. Then he defines some of what pursuing holiness would entail at the end of chapter 12. And now we get to 13. And I think what we're dealing here in 13 is still the question, what does it mean to pursue a life of holiness? But Paul realizes that there's a hotly debated, controversial issue afoot in, especially within Judaism at this time, and he feels a need to address the question, what would holiness require of a person with respect to how they respond to the governing authorities? Because that very issue is a controversial issue. So while he's in the middle of discussing what it would look like to live a life in pursuit of holiness, he decides to address himself to that controversy. Well, why is it controversial? We have to look at the historical context to understand that. The controversy is, how should a Jew, and for that matter then any person in pursuing holiness and righteousness, but in Judaism, it's how should a righteous Jew respond to a governing authority who is a godless heathen, right? The emperor in Rome is not exactly a follower of the Mosaic Covenant. He's not exactly a fearer of Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has nothing to recommend himself to the Jews. There's nothing about who he is and what he stands for that they would look at with any kind of respect. He's an enemy of God. He's an opponent to everything the Jews stand for. So how should they think about this Roman overlord over the Jews when God has asked them to honor and serve and love him and only him? I mean, they are probably undoubtedly aware that the Caesars about this time are claiming to be gods themselves. So you can see how within Judaism, if you have a Roman overlord claiming to be a god and worthy of worship, how do you be a monotheist who believes that you worship no other god but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and give any kind of tribute, any kind of deference, any kind of honor to this usurper, this false god, the Caesar? Well, within Judaism, there were different schools of thought. You had on the one hand the Herodians. The Herodians were basically the aristocratic, wealthy supporters of King Herod, who got all kinds of privileges from being connected with King Herod. They were very much in support of the status quo, which means they're very much in support of Rome. We need to honor Rome. We need to obey Rome. We need to do everything we can to cooperate with Rome. And the reason is their status, their place, their power, their wealth came from that and derived from that. So obviously they were very much in favor of that. Way over on the other extreme, you had radicals, zealots they were called. The zealots took the position that it was idolatrous, it was blasphemous to even pay taxes to Rome. To pay taxes to Rome was a breach of your loyalty to your God. So you did everything you could to avoid paying taxes. The very extreme form of the zealots, called the Sicarii, were literally terrorists and assassins. They would hide a dagger in their cloak, would go into the marketplace and would stab to get to death a Roman soldier if they could, a Herodian who was a collaborator with Rome. They literally stabbed them to death, disappear into the mob, and be gone. And that was their way of resisting and fighting the Roman authority. They were certainly the extreme. But the less extreme end of that school of thought were the Pharisees. The Pharisees basically took the position that you could pay taxes to Rome without without in some way forfeiting your claim to be a righteous and holy person. You weren't violating righteousness. You weren't violating holiness if you paid taxes. But their position was sort of, I mean, they're coming from a perspective that actually logically leads to the zealots and the Sicarii. Their position logically is it really is kind of idolatrous to honor this ungodly heathen emperor in Rome. But Pharisees being good at this sort of thing, they found a way to excuse that which even they would have thought was unrighteous, found a way around their own conscience and a way around their own sensibilities, because practically speaking, it's not going to work to resist Rome. So they would hold their nose and pay taxes. They had all the moral revulsion that the zealots would have had, but they justified their going through the motions of paying taxes and tribute and honor to Rome. Well, you remember in the gospel accounts, Jesus weighed in on this very issue. They at one point come to Jesus and ask him, is it right to pay taxes or not? If we don't know the background, it seems like a strange question to ask Jesus. It seems like it's coming out of the blue. But it's asking him to weigh in on a very hotly debated and very relevant controversy within Judaism. What should be our stance toward Rome as Jews? And if you remember his answer, somewhat cryptic, but I think in the end very enlightening, he asked for a coin, said, whose image is on it? And they had an image of Caesar on it. And then he said, well, then give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and give unto God that which is God's. I'm going to argue that Paul's answer here in this passage we're looking at is identical to Jesus' answer there. Give unto Caesar's that which is Caesar's, and give unto God that which is God's. That's in effect what Paul is answering here in Romans chapter 13. The other thing we need to recognize when we look at the historical background is the context historically in which Paul is writing this and into which Jesus spoke is not our context. Rome was not a modern constitutional democratic republic like America is. And that makes a difference. That the Jews of that time didn't really have a real viable option of resisting Rome. They eventually did, as we well know in history, eventually they did resist Rome, but they could only resist Rome by taking up arms. And when they took up arms, Rome crushed them twice. In 70 AD, and then again, when that wasn't enough and they took up arms again 50 years later, Rome came in and crushed them again and spread them to the four winds. They had enough of them. They cleansed Jerusalem, wiped it out, tore the temple down, and, well, they did that in 70 AD, but banished the Jews to the four winds of the Roman Empire. So anyone probably who could read the signs knew that resistance to Rome wasn't really going to work. You're just going to get yourself destroyed, which in history is exactly what happened. So there wasn't even really an option for them to resist. Now, maybe as we get in further into this passage, we'll see the relevance of that. But how are we to understand what Paul is saying here then in view of the context textually and historically? Paul's still answering the question, what will a life in pursuit of holiness look like? And he's turning his attention particularly to the controversy, what will a life in pursuit of holiness look like in relationship to a godless heathen governing authority? Well, his answer is a person who pursues holiness is actually demonstrating his holiness when he submits to a godless heathen authority. It's a very kind of ironic, unexpected answer within the context of Judaism. Paul and Jesus are actually taking a position that's actually even distinct from the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees would never have gone so far as to say, you are demonstrating your holiness by submitting to godless heathen authorities. Rather, they would have said, you're not in any way negating your holiness by doing so. In other words, it's acceptable, but let's not go overboard. It's not actually a good thing that you would submit to a godless heathen authority, but God will not hold it against you. I mean, it's not against holiness itself, but it's not a positive aspect of holiness. I think what we're finding here in this passage is that Paul is saying it's actually a positive element of holiness when we submit to a heathen, godless authority. Now, what's ironic about that is, what? How can it be a contribution, a positive contribution to holiness to submit to such authority? They're godless by definition. We're talking about a godless heathen. How can it be somehow righteous to submit to a godless heathen? Paul's answer is, because That godless heathen is just a pawn in God's hands. He's no competitor to God. He didn't defeat God to get himself in that position. And he's not in competition with God when he has that authority and is in that position. He's being used by God. God is the God who controls all of history. No one has power but what God grants them power. Remember Jesus' comment to Pilate when Pilate says to him, "Don't you know that I have the power of life and death over you?" And Jesus' response, "Well, you wouldn't have that if my Father hadn't given it to you." That it's the same perspective that Paul is giving here, is that no matter who is in power, no matter how godless they are, no matter how opposed to God they are, no matter how much enmity to God they might have, they wouldn't be there and have that kind of power and have that kind of authority if the God of all of history hadn't put them in place and granted it to them for a time. And that's important, for a time, for the time in which they hold that power. So when I submit to someone who's in that position of power, I'm not submitting to a competitor of God, someone that I believe is a false god that I'm worshiping instead of God. I'm submitting to the one that is fulfilling God's purposes at this point in history, at this time and place in history. That's not a bad thing to do. That's a good thing to do, Paul is saying. I'm respecting God's purposes. I'm respecting God's sovereignty. I'm respecting God's power. And I'm respecting, I already said it, God's purposes. That part of holiness is submitting, is knowing and understanding God in that way, knowing who he is, knowing that he's the determiner of all things, and then submitting to what God wants to accomplish in his sovereignty. By doing that, I mark myself a child of God. I am one of his children by so submitting to that. So the question is, though, what is this submission? What does it mean to acknowledge that God is using this person and has put them in place then? Where does that take us? What should we do to submit to such an authority? It's an acknowledgement that for now, God has placed this particular governing authority, governing power, in the position of power. But does it mean that this governing power is legitimate? Do I acknowledge the legitimacy of their power? And to not do so would be to be insubordinate? No, I don't think so. Nothing in what Paul is saying requires that we believe that their power be legitimate, because his basis for our submission is that it's the will of God. But it's the will of God whether they arrived at that power legitimately or illegitimately. God uses both means to accomplish his purposes. So I'm not acknowledging every governing authority is legitimate just because I'm submitting to it in the way that Paul is describing. To submit to it is to simply acknowledge that there's someone bigger than God who's back behind their exercising of their power and authority. Does submitting to that authority mean that I must always work, yea, even fight, to maintain that power, that authority in power? No, it doesn't mean that either. It's in power right now because God wants it in power. But God can remove that authority from power just as surely as he put that authority in power. And tomorrow he might do that. I mean, that's what history is made of, people that God set up and used them to exercise their power and of authority to accomplish his purposes. And then when he was done with them, he disposed of them. He took them down. You even in the book of Habakkuk, that's exactly what God describes to Habakkuk. Habakkuk is complaining about, in this case, what is it, Judah? Either Judah or Israel, I don't remember, but one of those Jewish kingdoms. He's complaining about their unrighteousness, and, yeah, it has to be Judah. He's complaining about their unrighteousness, and God comes along and says, I've got a deal. I'm going to whistle for the Chaldean. I'm going to bring the Chaldean in, and the Chaldean is going to judge this people. He's going to decimate them, wipe them out, take them captive, destroy them. So I will bring justice. I'm going to punish and discipline and chastise my own people. To which Habakkuk complains in response, but God, as bad as Judah is, the Chaldeans are worse. To which God says, oh yeah, yeah. I'm going to use them to chastise my people, and then I'm going to punish them for coming against my people. I'm going to punish them for their evil. They are so wicked that they deserve to be brought down, and I'll get there. I'm going to do that too. All governing authorities are ultimately just a pawn in God's game. And we don't understand God unless we know that. So, since we know that God raises people into authority and he brings people down and takes their authority away from them, since we know that's true, there's no obligation that we have to fight to maintain anybody in power and in authority. Does submitting to the governing authority mean that we must always obey that governing authority no matter what? No, surely that can't be true. Surely that's not what Paul is talking about. As Jesus said, we are to give to Caesar that which is Caesar's. But then he said, but we are to give to God's that which is God's. Give to God that which is God's. And I think he intended that to be a limit on what it is that we give to Caesar. We don't give to Caesar without qualification. We give to Caesar everything that he asks for, short of violating our obligation to God. But once that begins to transcend our obligation to God, no governing authority ever has the right to ask that of a citizen, to violate their loyalty and their obligation to God. So there's a limit placed on the authority that government has. Paul, I think, is assuming that same limitation here. He doesn't state it explicitly, but I don't think he has to state it explicitly. The reason he doesn't have to state it explicitly is because it's already implied in the question that he's answering. No Jew who is part of the controversy would have ever dreamt that you are to give full, unqualified, absolute allegiance to a godless heathen governing authority. Nobody would have taken that position. So Paul's not even afraid of someone even thinking in those terms. The question Paul is not answering is there any time that I could possibly disobey the governing authority? I mean, every Jew would have said, well, no, duh. I mean, he's not answering that question. He's answering the question, can I ever offer any token of honor to a godless heathen government? Their problem is giving anything like honor to the government, not giving unqualified obedience to the government. They never dreamt of that. They're not sure you can even pay taxes to this government. They're not even sure that you can even say long live Caesar to this government. That's what they're having a problem with. And Paul's weighing in on that, and he's saying, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, you can go ahead and pay taxes and say long live Caesar. He'll live as long as God wants him to. I mean, that's fine. You're not worshiping a false god if you do such a thing, because that governor wouldn't be there unless they were a tool in the hands of the one true God that you do honor and you do respect and you do obey and serve. So he doesn't have to explicitly state that there's a limit because it's already built into the question that he's addressing. It's important that we understand when a biblical text is answering a question, it's important that we understand how to understand the answer to a question. We have to allow the nature of the question to direct us to the right way to understand the answer to that question. There was I never actually saw it, but I heard people talking about a skit that was on Sunday Night Live years and years and years ago. And those of you who actually know the skit don't, I'm not going to get the details right. I never saw it myself. But it had something to do with some people working at a nuclear reactor, and there were some warning signs going off or something, and they needed to address the problem in the nuclear reactor. And I don't know if they called out for some advice or something, but the advice that came to them was, you can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor. To which I think a debate ensued about the two different ways that the people had heard that. One thought it meant it's not possible to put too much water in a nuclear reactor because it needs water, and so it's just you can't ever overdo it. You'll be just fine. The other one thought, if you put too much water in a nuclear reactor, you're going to risk some kind of disaster. And so they couldn't decide what to do because they had interpreted the advice differently. That's what's going on in this passage. If we don't understand the question, we're likely to misunderstand his answer. The question that he's asking is, as I've just said, Is it ever possible to show any kind of honor to a godless heathen government? Is that ever right? And he's answering that, yes, it is. But if you come into the passage with your question being, can I ever disobey a governing authority? Then the very wording that Paul uses steers you in the question of, no, you better not ever disobey a governing authority. They're from God, and you should be submitting to them and doing everything that they say. But that's because you've come into the passage expecting a certain question to be answered that Paul is not addressing, at least not in those terms. His readers are going into it thinking, boy, we shouldn't. We're being disloyal. We're being idolatrous. If we pay taxes to Caesar, aren't we being disloyal if we pay taxes to Caesar, Paul? And that's what he's answering. And if you read it that way, then his words have very, very different meaning to you. His emphasis on they've been appointed by God is not his way of saying every word that comes out of the mouth of Caesar is straight from God himself and you better obey it. He's simply saying, don't you know that he's just a pawn in the hands of God who's governing all of history? He's appointed by God. He's there by God. You're not being disloyal to God when you obey him. I hope that's clear, but it makes all the difference in the world what you think the question is, how are you going to read Paul's answer? So with that in mind, let me read it again. His question is, can I ever pay taxes? Can I ever pay honor, show any honor to Caesar? Every person is to place himself under the prevailing authorities, for there is no authority if it is not by God. And those that exist have been placed there by God. Consequently, the one who stands in opposition to the authority has taken a stand against the directive of God. So his point is to connect this godless authority with the purposes of God as being used by God for his purposes, not as competing with God as if he were some kind of false god or competitive authority. Now, the problem is, of course, we don't have an answer yet to where that you draw the line between giving unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and giving unto God that which is God's. We want desperately for Paul to draw the line for us. Tell us when we have stopped doing one and are doing the other. He doesn't give us an answer. He doesn't intend to give us an answer. I think I know Paul well enough to know that he would refuse to give an answer. It depends on the circumstances. Part of why we expect an answer is because we have a faulty notion of what the Bible is. We expect the answer to be a kind of, we expect the Bible to be a kind of answer book. That we come to it with questions, and if we look hard enough and deep enough and far enough, we're going to find an answer to my question, because of course God would have revealed the answer to my question. And if we don't have it here in this chapter, then it's this chapter in conjunction with other passages in the Bible, and we just need to find the right passages and patch them together until we get God's answer to my question. But that's not what the Bible is. And that's not what God is doing in our lives. God is not in the business of making rule followers. He doesn't want us to memorize his rules, submit to his rules, and follow his rules. God is in the business of actually making us wise. His children are to become children of wisdom. We are to become people who have so inculcated within our own understanding the values of God, the priorities of God, the perspectives of God, the purposes of God, the promises of God, that all of that has been so inculcated that we can put that together, and in my particular situation, whatever the particular challenges I face, I can understand how all of that gives me insight into how to behave in this situation. That's wisdom. And God's intention is to equip me to be wise, not to give me an answer to my question and then ask me to follow it to the letter. It's a very, very different expectation than many Christians think. I mean, there's so much in Christian culture that has encouraged us to think in terms of being rule followers, with the Bible being the rule book that we need to follow. That's not what the Bible is, and that's not what God is doing in our lives. So we're not going to get an answer to that question. And do you see how much more complex it is in our situation? We don't live in the Roman Empire. We live in a constitutional democratic republic where ostensibly, rumor has it, that the government is us. It's a government of the people, by the people, for the people, not the government of a ruling class. Wink, wink. But at least in principle, at least in theory, if we are the government, that gives us a kind of social and political latitude that Paul never dreamt of. Paul never even imagined. So when we ask questions about whether or not I should submit to authority, we need to take into account our situation in history, our political circumstances. They're not the same as his. And he wouldn't have even dreamt of giving us an answer to our problem, our challenge of knowing what wisdom dictates about how we honor God in a modern democratic republic. Okay, let's look at the structure of what he says in this passage and how that works, and then I want to open it up to your questions and comments. In paragraph 112, the one I just finished reading, he lays out basically God's sovereign control over all of history as the basis for his answer to the question whether it's right and holy to honor godless and heathen authorities, and we've really explored that. He's saying, yes, because they're just doing the purposes of God, they are not false gods. You know that they're not a god at all, so you can honor them without being in danger of idolatry. Then in 113, he talks about the consequences of not obeying them, of not submitting to and resisting to them. And basically the whole paragraph is saying, if you don't, you risk being punished by the governing authorities. Now, there are a couple of places in this that are ambiguous. What's the wrath that he's talking about you're in danger of? Is it eternal wrath, wrath at the end of time, condemnation by God himself? And in my judgment, no, that's not what he's talking about. The wrath he's talking about is the wrath of the governing authority, and I've translated it accordingly. So now those who have taken a stand against it, against the governing authority, will receive a sentence on themselves. By whom? By the governing authorities. Those who rule are not a terror to good behavior, but to bad behavior. Do you want to be afraid of the authority? Do good, and you will have praise from him, that governing authority. For he is a servant of God for your benefit. Now we'll come back to that. To bring about a good thing. But if you do bad, then be afraid, for he does not carry the sword without purpose. Indeed, he is a servant of God, an avenger who brings wrath against the one who practices bad behavior. Basically, Paul is spelling out a rudimentary political theory here, that his political theory is that the purpose and role of governmental authority is to bring social order. He's to punish antisocial behavior and to allow socially behavior that allows for social harmony. That's the purpose of government. And so when you resist the governing authority, Paul is saying, you can bet that that governing authority is going to come back down on you, because it's seeking to establish and maintain the order. And you're disrupting the order when you oppose the authority, so you can bet it's going to come back at you. And you're going to potentially suffer. You're going to be sentenced by that governing authority. So, and part of what he's saying is, that's just innately the nature of political authority, and that's what God has ordained. That's the purpose that God is fulfilling by having that governing authority in place. So you better be sure that you're obeying God instead of Caesar when you resist the authority, because it's going to cost you. In all likelihood, it will cost you. Then in 114, he sums up the reasons for pursuing that one should, when they pursue holiness, should submit to governing authorities, and he reduces it to two things: because you risk the intrinsically appropriate wrath of the government if you don't, and then secondly, it's a matter of moral conviction. He just mentions it in passing. It's the right thing to do. God's will just is being done by having that particular authority and power, so to honor what God is doing is a right thing. It's not a wrong thing to do. So I think what he's doing there is summarizing the point that was implicit in paragraph 112. Because this is the providence of God at work, then it really is a matter of moral conscience that you honor God by honoring his purposes, and honoring his purposes includes honoring the governing authority that he has put in place. And then 115, he basically sums up this whole thing in terms of the controversial issues that were being debated at the time. Should we pay taxes? Should we offer tribute? Should we show honor? Should we fear the godless heathen who's in authority? And he just simply explicitly weighs in on that. Give to all the things that are due them. Tribute to the one owed tribute, that is, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Tax to the one owed tax, fear to the one owed fear, honor to the one owed honor. So he just makes explicit his answer to the controversial questions that are being debated. So he does that and sums that up, and then he's actually doing a second thing. This paragraph is then a transition to the next point that he's going to make, which is an entirely different point. But notice he says, give to all things that which is due them, and then he begins the next section, paragraph 116, verse 8 of 13, leave no unsatisfied debts to anyone except to love one another. So we'll come and look at that point either later or next week, but I think 115 forms a transition to that next point. Now, let me entertain your questions or comments.
Early in my Christian life, I guess you'd say, I was like 19, 20. There were quite a few people, at least in some of the group, thought that, you know, speed limits were not right. And I thought it was ironic that they said it was wrong, but they had the police detectors, the radar detectors. And what I want to ask is, the Herodians, how would you kind of interpret, or how would you kind of think of them today? I'm kind of thinking people who would say, like, you know, it's okay if we do abortion, you know, or other things, that these are laws and we can go along with that. Is these the type of things the Herodians would be doing? Do you understand what I'm asking? Okay, it's a little difficult to kind of like, okay, put the two together, but let's say a Herodian might say, oh yeah, I can say Caesar's a god, it's not that big a deal. And today somebody would say, okay, yeah, abortion's okay. The government allows it, and, you know, it's a good way to kind of hide things. And, I mean, one thing I have noticed in churches is the women who carry their child are really harshly criticized when the covered sin is just, you know, ignored like it didn't happen. So would these, kind of these Herodians be these type of people who would say, okay, it's the law, I'm going to go ahead and obey it?
Not really. I mean, the okay. Herodians are more likely. I was listening to the television the other day, and a consultant of Jimmy Carter was on, and he made the claim that Congress today might as well be Sodom and Gomorrah. It is so corrupt. And, I mean, I don't know. I'm not back there. I'm not seeing what's going on. But what he was implying in the context is the dealing, the mutual watching out for one another's back and giving favors to one another is so extensive right now that he's never seen anything like the kind of corruption that's going on there right now. Well, that's the Herodians. The people who are in a position of power, they are the ruling class. They maintain one another in power and the ruling class by using what authority has been granted them by us through our votes to increase their position of power, their wealth, their influence, their authority, and so on. And that in of itself may not be so bad, but they do so breaking the very laws that they would insist that we obey. I mean, that there's dishonesty, there's corruption, and so on. So that's the Herodians. The Herodians of that time were breaking the back of the people with taxations and getting wealthy off of it. And they could legally charge the taxes that they did because Rome didn't care as long as Rome got their cut. But there was nothing moral about the taxes that they were charging. They were exorbitant, and they were crushing the economy of the people. So it's when people in a position of power, the Herodians represent those people who in a position of power think that they're above morality, above the law. Morality is for other people to obey. Laws are for other people to obey, but not me, because I'm too good to be confined by rules.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I really appreciate this today because especially last week, I was having difficulty with our current administration apparently like throwing Israel under the bus. So, you know, this does ease my mind a little on that.
Yeah, I may have commented on this a few weeks ago, but I think I really lost sight of this very thing that Paul is saying here over the last couple of years as I've grown alarmed by the kind of corruption and the kind of animosity toward everything that I believe in and everything that I value is being kind of institutionalized in our government, and I began to freak out, you know. And it is actually a place to rest when we realize that wouldn't be happening if God weren't allowing it. They're in place because God is accomplishing his purposes. However corrupt it is, however illegitimate it is, however evil it is, that doesn't matter. God is not going to be thwarted by evil. It's no match for God's power and God's sovereignty. His will is going to be done. It also helps the more I realize how corrupt we are, what we deserve, and it's a little easier for me to take what's happening when I realize how much we deserve what's happening to us, that at the rank and file how corrupt we have become. When we look at how sexually impure this culture is becoming, how dishonest, how much lying has become a part of our lives and our culture, that the level of corruption among us is so horrendous that why should we be surprised that our government is corrupt? We're corrupt. So it's not like we don't deserve all this. We can still pray to God for mercy and that he can bring about repentance and redemption and turn things around. Maybe we can have a reformation of some kind. But But even the Reformation wasn't a reformation. So, who knows? But it is a place to rest for me. It's very, very helpful to know that this is, God is still in control. He's not losing a battle.
I was raised in a family where we were not allowed to call our teachers by their names in school.
By their first names, you mean, or
last names? We couldn't say Lyons or Johnson. Oh. When we were talking about we at the table around the home. It's Mr. Johnson.
Oh.
It's Mr. Lyons, over the years, it was repeated to me that that's because they're an authority, and we were taught that authority is a real thing that exists in this world, and you have to understand it and respect it and whatnot. And so, I think I grew up understanding that, and I believe it. And it's I just want to preface my comments with that. So we live in this world where. Our heroes are people like Paul, who said, am I serving God or man? Of course I wouldn't give man what he wants if it puts me against God. So we have this divide between the moral part of our reality and the instrumental part of our reality in our government and in our economy and whatnot. So, for the example of speed limits, God, speed limits, it's completely arbitrary. You know, you crunch the numbers and you say, well, this many people are going to die and this many state policemen are going to have to respond to the wrecks and this is going to be the cost of the roads, and they come up with a speed limit, say 55. It's not a moral decision, right? So who cares what the speed limit is? But when the government says, this will be your curriculum in school, or this is how much you will pay for, say, abortion, those are moral issues. And it seems to me that a person has either the right or the obligation to say, I'll drive your speed limit, but you're not going to teach that to my child. Or I'll pay him a highway tax. I use him. I'm not going to pay taxes to a government that murders millions of unborn children every year. Okay, so that becomes the debate. And it seems to me that a case could be made that on the moral issues, a person has no choice but to maybe rebel against government decree. But on the non-moral issues, because they are an authority, and they have that authority because it's not moral, they're obligated to obey. Does that make sense? I mean, is there?
Yeah, it does make sense. But remember, there were a whole lot of things Caesar did that their taxes were going to support as well. I'm not sure. Once you get into the logic of indirect guilt, I don't know. I just think it gets really absurd. I mean, back in the Vietnam War, there are people who withhold a part of their phone bill because that paid taxes and that was supporting the war effort in Vietnam. I just always thought that was silly. I'm also breathing and I'm contributing to the carbon dioxide that's feeding the vegetation that is going towards supporting the war effort. And so should I stop breathing? That there comes a point where indirect guilt is just an absurdity. It's something to make me feel good about myself. It's not something that's actually accomplishing anything, and it's actually not resisting evil. So I'm not a real fan of indirect guilt. If you're paying taxes, all you're doing is paying taxes, and what your government does with those taxes, that's on their shoulders, and God's going to hold them accountable. That's not on my shoulders, I think. But something like the curriculum, that's another issue. That's not a matter of indirect guilt. You're actually trying to decide, are you going to allow the government to indoctrinate your own children that you have responsibility for in values and beliefs and perspectives that you think are contrary to everything good and right and true? I think that's a very responsible choice. The question is then, how do you fight it? How do you resist? What exactly, where do we take that? And that's where I'm saying we just need to be wise. I don't have answers to that, but we can't get our answers from Paul because he's not in our social context. You know, we still have the rights right now to vote and to campaign for different causes and educate. We have a lot of freedom to be able to try to make a difference, and there's certainly nothing wrong with doing that. Our government allows us to do that still so far, and I think we should if we're called to that.
The argument is made that God brings judgment against nations, but those nations are made up of people, and not all the people are guilty of what God is bringing judgment
that's
down
true.
On them for.
That's true.
And so some people would try to, quote unquote, reduce the amount of sin in a culture to reduce the risk of judgment for everybody. And I've heard that argument be used, say, against abortion or war or whatnot. And Albert Speer wrote a book. He was Hitler's Ministry of Arms and his architect. And he was recounting there was a lot of discussion among the higher-ups towards the end of the war about killing Hitler. There were, 15, 17 different plots to kill Hitler. And in one of these discussions where it was being discussed, quote-unquote, theoretically, the generals were, in this particular plot, were trying to bring Speer into the plot to get him to cooperate, to test him to see if he would help. And during the discussion, one of the generals just finally said, no. It's wrong to interfere with God when he is judging a people. And that's what's happening to us. So he stepped out of the plot to increase the chances that more destruction would come upon his own people because of what they had done, because they deserved it. I thought, was that the right choice? Was that a morally admirable position?
Well, that's a great question. A similar question. What would a Christian do during the colonies in their fighting King George? Would a Christian be supportive of King George because he was the governing authority that God had placed over them? Or could he participate in the revolution or emancipation or whatever you call it because, because it's the right thing to do? I'm not sure that at that time that there was necessarily a right answer that would apply to every individual. There may have been a right answer, but the point is, I think two people could have come to different conclusions and each be holy in their decision, if you follow what I'm saying. God's going to take care of history. If he wants King George to lose America, King George is going to lose America with or without me. The important thing is that I am pursuing holiness the best I know how to do with the wisdom that I have. And the issues sometimes are so complex. In fact, the issues are of such a nature that how you can really know the right thing to do without knowing the future. So it's very conceivable that two people could come down on two sides of an issue like that and both be utterly, and hear God say to both of them, well done, good and faithful servant. Maybe not that. That's Jesus gets that. Not half bad, dude. from God. Both people getting that because they have pursued it with integrity, with a love of God, with a desire to serve God, the best they know how to do. So, did he do the right thing? His reasoning might have been completely sound and potentially righteous and holy. But I don't know. I mean, ultimately, God's going to have to sort that out, I think.
Okay, looking at the big picture, knowing that Paul did not give us a yes or no answer, but rather a big picture, wisdom-based ethic. So putting into this picture of what kind of wisdom-based ethic can one use so that knowing what wisdom-based ethic one can use for dealing with situations, Would it work to include forgive us as we forgive our debtors, the sense of, okay, here I am, professional sinner, I mess up left and right, and I do want to get things right, and I do need and want, in my heart of hearts, to be corrected and do what is right, and there's a certain gentleness and firmness that people have blessed me with in bringing about my correction. Ergo, in contending for goodness in government or social situations, that does it work to then trust that that I will appropriately speak up with the same fervency, but recognition that I'm as messed up as they are, and that I want to use only as much force as is would be appropriate to me, that I wouldn't be gloating over a victory, but rather just, oh gosh, that's good, that's over with, repentance is brought, or just, okay, God, you know, I did my best, I spoke up as much as I could. I'll leave this rest in your hands. Does this kind of give an extra synthesis?
So let me see if I get your question. Does my knowledge of my own brokenness and fallenness mean that I should disagree with others with a certain amount of, what's the word? Empathy? Okay. Yes. Empathy, yes. Whether we're nice about it is more a cultural value than a moral value, I think. I mean, the more I look at human interactions, I mean, different cultures behave toward one another in a different way, and what we count as respect or disrespect is largely because of our cultural lenses. I've just been reading a book on Israel and the economics and the prosperity of Israel, and one of the points that the book makes is that it's an incredibly informal culture. They don't, I mean, notice that Netanyahu is called Bibi. I mean, a nickname by himself, by everybody. I mean, he's the prime minister of the nation, but everyone on the street calls him Bibi. And the point that they make is that that's universal in their culture. Generals, CEOs, they all have nicknames that their underlings give them. And when you get in a business meeting, it's culture shock for American businessmen to go to Israel, because they go into a business meeting and you have all these junior employees arguing with the CEO, saying you're wrong, that's not right. And that's culture shock, because you wouldn't, I don't know, I've never been in business, but presumably you wouldn't do that here in America. I've never met a CEO in my life. I've probably offended them and not even known it. But you wouldn't do that in America. But they do that routinely. But I think that's just part of the culture. They don't take it as disrespect. They take it as a very important value because of the open and honest dialogue gives them rich resources to work with. So, and we've known people in our own culture. I mean, some of the nicest people I've ever met are gruff, harsh-talking old men. But it's crusty on the outside and a heart of gold on the inside, right? Well, it's a heart of gold on the inside that really counts more than the crusty veneer and exterior. That's more a question of culture and personal values and personal style and all that kind of stuff. And part of our learning to respect each other is to learn to know somebody else's style. That when you call me a blooming idiot, you don't mean any disrespect. You know, when I come to understand that, then I can give you the grace to allow you to do that. But instead of just taking offense and writing you off, maybe I need to learn what that means when you call me an idiot. You see what I'm saying? So maybe I'm not even getting to the heart of your question, but I think we can vary in our style, in our personal style. But should we empathize with one another's brokenness? Absolutely. Otherwise, we don't understand ourselves. Yeah?
Kind of dialing in, tuning the degree of, you know, the type of interaction to show that grace.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I assume it was the political discussion that you had in mind, that how nasty we get in political discussion, and or not necessarily. Okay.
I'm having a hard time with a loving and peaceful God based on your story of, or the biblical story of God using a group of people to go against Judah and then going to condemn them afterwards. I'm mm-hmm. having a hard time with that concept. How is he still loving and peaceful when he's using groups of people or people to do his will, which it doesn't seem to be a loving and peaceful nature?
Okay. Well, that's a huge question. As long as we think of God as like us, as a bigger version of us, then I don't think what I'm saying makes any sense. And therefore I don't think what the Bible says about God makes any sense. As long as he is just a bigger version of me. So the only way we can make sense out of what I think the Bible is actually teaching here is to realize that God is a whole nother kind of being. We are the characters. He is the author. He's the author of our being. God uses everyone and everything all the time because he doesn't have any option. I mean, he's the author. He's the storyteller. He's creating characters and eliminating characters. He's creating characters to be exactly what he wants in order to advance the story. It's all under his control. And I think if we don't understand that that's who God is, then we don't really understand the God of the Bible. But once you take that leap and allow God to be the author of all of history and my very being, then, you know, think of Tolkien writing Lord of the Rings. I mean, from the standpoint of him being the author, what's the guy's name, the bad guy? Sauron didn't have a chance. He was going to go down. He was going to be destroyed. But why was he going to be destroyed? Because he was also authored by Tolkien to be an evil man, freely making choices that were evil. And so his end was appropriate to the kind of character he was. He was evil, and he was destroyed for his evil. In real life, there are people who are evil, and they will be destroyed for their evil. Their end is appropriate to who they are. Do they have an option about being the evil characters that they are? Well, not ultimately, because ultimately God is big enough to be the author of all reality, so completely and totally in control of all reality, that if he wants me to be an evil character, he will create me an evil character. And I will know that I'm an evil character because out of the freedom of my will, I freely choose the evil that makes me evil. And then I'm going to be punished accordingly. But that's what's behind Habakkuk. You know, he's creating in the hearts of the Chaldeans greed, a love of violence that drives them to come in and wreak havoc in the land. But then God is going to turn around and judge them for that very greed and violence that is driving them. Because that's the appropriate thing to do against people who are greedy and violent. That's what should be done to them. But that's a long conversation that we'll need to continue over and over again.
Okay, now I'm speaking for Deanna.
Okay.
And I would say, you know, the problem with, you know, the government taking some of our taxes to fund abortions and stuff, to countermand that, you can contribute to the crisis support centers and take a tax deduction.
Yeah, that'll fix them. Anything else? Okay.